Welcome to the Deep Side of Dallas podcast. I'm Paul Corliss, Chief Communications Officer for the University of North Texas System, here with my co-host, Rudy Bush of the Dallas Morning News. When discussing American literature, we often hear the term great American novel used to describe a work of fiction that paints a vivid picture of a key time in American history. And it's an easy term for Texans to adapt and make their own, with Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove perhaps serving as the most obvious example of the great Texan novel. But if we localize even more and apply that great novel concept to modern-day Dallas, one name jumped out for Rudy Bush, and that's Ben Fountain, author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And for this episode of the podcast, we are thrilled to have that award-winning author join us in studio. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Hey, thanks so much, Ben. And I've been a fan and a reader for some years now, and you and I met not long after Billy Lynn was published. And I revisited the novel not too long ago and got to thinking about the conceptualization of Dallas and of our the place we live in a literary sense. And of course, your writing really goes all over the world. It goes all over the country. You've written a powerful set of short stories that take place in South America and take place in Haiti. But of course, Billy Lynn is the novel that many of us know you best for, because much of it takes place in the old Texas Stadium there in Irving, which would have been, by the way, 50 years old this year, believe it or not. And there are a lot of descriptions of that stadium in the book, the way it smelled, which wasn't particularly good towards the end, and the way it felt to kind of be in a game there that ring absolutely dead on to those of us who experienced that. But I just wanted to have you here because I really wanted to talk about how you tried to capture this place where we live from a literary point of view, and what it was that you were taking away from the place where we live for Billy Lynn.
Well, starting out with this book, Billy Lynn, I felt pretty overwhelmed at first. I felt like there was a great deal of potential in that seed story, a group of American soldiers, combat soldiers, who are presented as guests of honor at the Dallas Cowboys Thanksgiving Day game. And I just felt a lot of weight bearing down on that particular scenario. I mean, we're talking about, you know, it takes place in 2004, so we're talking about, you know, we're right in the middle of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and just after a presidential election. It felt like to me then that a sea change had happened in America with the attacks of 9/11. America had gone crazy and had really not regained its sanity. And so trying to capture that, you know, if it felt, you know, just like a tremendous pressure bearing down on me. And the way I got a grip on myself was tell the story. Just work it from the line out, line by line, you know, character by character, scene by scene. And if I'm writing it properly, the other stuff will take care of itself. The so-called big stuff, yeah. The big themes, you know, whatever you want to call it, the you know, observations of society and culture and politics and power and money, just write the damn story, and if you write it correctly, all those other things will be, you know, in those paragraphs and in those lines. So, I think for me it was just scene by scene, character by character, trying to write the story as accurately as I could. And so within that endeavor, I found myself obviously thinking a lot about Dallas and a lot about the whole milieu of Texas Stadium and just the whole phenomenon of the Dallas Cowboys and of the NFL and of American life in general and what was going on in our collective life at that particular point in time. So, you know, it seemed to me just a natural part of the story. I mean, here Billy Lynn, a 19-year-old combat soldier, is caught up in a number of systems that are so much bigger than he is. And he is trying to figure out where he stands in all of this. And it's not an idle inquiry on his part. I mean, his life might depend on it, what his country is going to ask him to do. And so really it's just, I mean, I am kind of a thick, slow writer. It takes me a long time to figure things out to the extent I ever do. And I really have to start small at the level of the line.
Yeah, well, I it comes through because Billy is a sort of quintessential real Texas kid who all these very strange things are happening to in this very short period of time. And I read the novel when it came out. I just reread it a couple of weekends ago. And I thought, boy, how salient are these themes of politics and celebrity and the show and sex and commerce and all of these things that get mixed up in Texas Stadium. And I started to think about the history of Dallas as I thought about that and how H.L. Hunt was funding radio programs that were designed to create sort of propagandist material around kind of the Bircher movement and things of that nature. And just before we started recording, you and I were having a little conversation, and you said, you know, you don't really see this as a Dallas novel. It's a novel that takes place in Texas Stadium. And I said, look, I think a lot of what I see as an element of Dallas, I can't see it anymore as all Dallas because I've been here too long and dug too deeply. But boy, some of the characters in here and the way that they lead their lives, where patriotism and commerce and money and sex and show all get mixed up, that has a lot to do in my mind with kind of the Dallas story. Am I way out of left field?
No, I don't think you are at all. I think if you go to any big city in America, you're going to find that to one extent or another. I think in a way, Dallas, I can argue it's the most American city because you find the purest strain of so many of those things. You know, the notion of capitalism and commerce as the only way for society to be structured. And, you know, faith in the mainstream narrative of, you know, American history. And again, American capitalism, American business. And so I think, you know, in Dallas, you get a really, like, you are mainlining that stuff. And you know, the NFL has made a lot of money off of hitching its star to all of those things. And certainly Dallas, you know, stands at the forefront of that.
Well, the NFL piece is particularly interesting to me in the context of a statement you made when you were answering kind of our first question. You said America had kind of gone crazy after 9/11. And I actually worked for the NFL during that time. I worked for the New Orleans Saints. And interestingly, I attended the first game in New York City or Giant Stadium in New Jersey after 9/11, which was fascinating. And I also worked the Super Bowl that year. And I can remember, you know, the pageantry of the NFL sort of leveraging what had happened, and U2's playing, and there's a scroll of names of everybody that passed away, and I'm literally crying. And I'm wondering, what were your inspiration as far as that, you know, America had gone crazy statement, and then using the NFL and the Texas Stadium as sort of a backdrop for that story? I think it's a really interesting connection, and wonder how that sort of came together in your mind.
Well, I mean, there's nothing realer than what happened on 9/11. And, I mean, this same organization, Al-Qaeda, this wasn't the first time they had attacked us. They had attacked us by land, sea, and air. I mean, by land with the first attacks on the World Trade Center in 1993, and then by sea, the USS Cole, and then by air with the attacks of 9/11. So, I mean, we were under serious attack by a deadly enemy, and that is a first-order reality that should be acknowledged for what it is. To conflate that with, and look, I mean, demonstrations, expressions of grief, of concern, of sympathy are absolutely appropriate. And collective expressions like that are absolutely appropriate. What I started sensing pretty early, and this is me, is a fair amount of cynicism going on in leveraging these very real emotions, personal and collective, for the purpose of boosting somebody's brand. And I felt like that only gained momentum as the years went by.
Yeah, it's an interesting take that isn't one that you obviously go to, but I think it works for sure.
Oh, it does work for sure. And, you know, your most recent book, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong about that, Beautiful Country, Burn Again, which is a collection of essays really from the 2016 campaign trail. And as I was reading that, then, of course, Dallas shows up here and there in the essays. But I couldn't help but think you had to write that because truth had become stranger than fiction. And I don't know, what took you out on the campaign trail? Because as a guy who spent a little time on it, it's not always that fun.
Right. Well, I had fun, okay. But I was a dilettante.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
I was kind of
you
parachuting.
Were just parachuting. Yeah.
I was parachuting in. I was kind of like the fighter pilot. You guys are down there in the trenches slogging it out. And I do a strafing run or two, and then I'm back at the base in time for drinks. You know, it's so I got the sweet spot of it. But you know, as 2015 was coming to a close, I felt like we were really entering uncharted territory. Just looking at the Trump phenomenon, and how he had done and said things that would have exploded a conventional candidate's campaign way back in August, and he was riding higher than ever, and I felt like something's going on here. And then the Guardian got in touch with me and said, we want to send you out on the campaign trail because we think it's going to be a crazy year. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. And I wanted to try it. I felt like there were things going on that I needed to try to understand just from my own peace of mind. I didn't know if I could do it. I'd never done anything like this before. And the folks at The Guardian were great. They said, write about whatever you want to write. We'll send you wherever you want to go within reason. You can write pretty much as long as you want because most of this is going to be posted on the internet as opposed to being print. And
these are the kind of editors who ruin our reputation.
They were really great to work with, as I'm sure you are too.
Wow.
But I just felt like, okay, I want to try this. I want to try to get some kind of handle on what's going on.
Yeah, and it's a terrific book. And, you know, I have my little dog-eared and even a little bit dog-eaten copy here, and I was trying to find the exact page, Ben, because I think at one point you're kind of back in or near North Dallas neighborhood, and I know you lived in North Dallas for a little while. I don't know if you still do, but as I recalled the passage, which of course I can't flip right to this moment, but you were seeing signs that were really in opposition to kind of the Trump movement, if I'm recalling the passage correctly. And I'm just trying to think of what you were seeing from Dallas at the time that all of this kind of 2016 strange national passage was going on. What was going through your mind about your town?
Well, I think we were all processing a lot of information then. We had a lot coming at us. And that's part of the point of the Book of Days sections in the book, where between each chapter, I give you my rundown of that month's, you know, highlights and lowlights and weirdness. And that's me trying to at least capture the tone and the spirit of just how crazy that year was. You know, I mean, I've lived in North Dallas for 35 years in the same house. And And I think, you know, that area has changed a fair amount over the years. I was seeing as many Hillary signs as I was Trump signs. And but I knew if you went out into, as soon as you got outside of the, you know, urban areas, I knew from experience, it would be all Trump. And, you know, it's a very bifurcated electorate. But I felt like going into 2016, early 2016, I felt like Trump's got a 50-50 chance. And it's just, I just felt like we are in the presence of a phenomenon we have not experienced on this level and of this power in the United States. And you know, I think we were all waiting for the thing that would cause him to crash and burn. Well, he's done it now. Well, he's gone too far. And you know, and when the Access Hollywood, right, or Hollywood Access tape came out in early October, it was, you thought for sure that's it.
Yeah, for sure.
And yet he defied, I mean, Trump was and is a true political phenomenon, and he has defied all the known laws of political physics so far.
Oh, no question about that part. You know, I used to think I knew something about politics, and then 2016 happened, and I realized I really don't know a thing about it.
Yeah, I mean, Trump was, he was speaking a powerful truth in the campaign, and that is, you, the working people of America, you've been shafted by the system. And that was a powerful truth, and it was absolutely true. The last 40 years had been really bad for the working people of America, and you know, most of us felt it, you know, on one level or another. Now, if you applied any kind of analysis to his actual platform and what he was talking about, as far as ways to remedy that, I mean, very quickly the analysis broke down. I mean, he wouldn't even take a clear stand on the minimum wage. I mean, he spun like a weather vane, and that was pretty much the way he was through the whole campaign. But his visceral appeal and that one basic truth that he kept hammering over and over, you know, the system is crooked, you've been shafted by the system, that rang true.
Yeah. Your analytical mind leads me to something I thought was important to share with our listeners, and that you, prior to becoming an author, you worked as an attorney. How did that transition happen, and how does your past life as an attorney play into, you know, your philosophies that you've articulated in your written works?
Well, I came to Dallas in 1983 out of law school. I followed a girl here. And
Duke actually, Law School, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah,
big time,
yeah.
Law school.
And I actually got her to marry me, and we're still married. She hasn't kicked me out yet. But I practiced law from 83 to 88, and I was a real estate finance lawyer. And so I was practicing during the boom and bust of the savings and loan industry, and was right in the middle of it. And that was an education in itself. And to be in Dallas during that era of, you know, high flyers,
right,
and major, you know, tragic downfalls of so many people who flew high and felt like they were immune to gravity. I mean, that was a great experience. I did it for 5 years. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I got out. As far as writing goes, I mean, it was a great education in the way the world works. I think as far as just writing at the level of the line, it really held me back for a long time. To be a good fiction writer, I think you have to, emotional logic is the main thing you had to be keyed into. Whereas, you know, if you're a lawyer, it's more the rational side of things. B follows from A, C follows from B, Whereas, you know, in matters of the human heart and human nature, often you're going from A to M, you know, back to D, and then over to T. And it took me a long time to get out of that kind of lockstep frame of mind.
Did you always envision yourself as someone who might may write a novel? Was that something that you had, you know, prior to going into law, thought about?
Yeah, I think it was something I was serious about from the age of 17 or 18. And it scared me. It seemed like the hardest thing I could try to do. And
so uncertain, right?
So uncertain just in terms of can you do the work? I mean, you know, you can be really smart, you can be a talented writer, et cetera, but whether you have that God-given dollop of talent that you can develop, I mean, who knows until you make a serious attempt at trying. And, you know, I think I went to law school trying to avoid it, telling myself, well, maybe I'll try one day, but thinking, nah, I probably won't ever try. And actually, this is okay. This feels pretty safe to me, going and practicing law and having a lucrative career and a respectable career where, you know, your parents, your in-laws, everybody's like, oh, you know, he's solid citizen, you know, making a lot of money, taking care of his family. And then to quit at the age of 30, you know, to do this completely irrational, really indefensible thing, it was a pretty radical shift.
The other thing that's so daunting is you need your big break, right? It's you could be a great performer, you could be a great actor, but if you don't catch the eye of the right person, you never get the chance to share your, you know, your talents.
I think there's more luck involved in show business, you know, acting. I think in writing there's still rough justice out there even now. I think if you're doing good work, sooner or later it will get recognized on some level. And I mean, I wrote for 17 years before I got a book contract. I mean, I meant it when I said I'm a slow, thick writer. And I really didn't deserve for good things to start happening for me until about the time they did. I mean, it just, I finally started doing decent work about 10 years in. And for me, it happened a little later maybe than it could have. But I think there was rough justice, you know, in the way it worked out for me.
I tend to agree with that, you know, in the journalism world too. The cream tends to just rise to the top if you got to do the work, and then the cream rises to the top. I want to get back to this Dallas question, since that's, I guess, the name of the show, right?
Deep Side of Dallas.
You turned me on, Ben, some years ago to Bud Schrake, who is, of course, one of a handful of really excellent sports writers at the Dallas Morning News kind of in the 50s, 60s, and then went on to a broader writing career and really became sort of a Texas figure in a lot of ways. But there's a letter that Schrake wrote actually to Larry L. King, a fellow writer, on August 7th, 1969, where he's describing Dallas, and he says, "Oligarchy likes to keep things quiet, smooth, gray, lifeless." And he's talking about really the nature of Dallas power and how the structures of the city are such that not much needs to happen here, and we don't really like it that much when things happen. And I think that's true, and people often wonder, you know, Dallas doesn't have kind of these, we're getting better, but for a long time we didn't have great parks, and we didn't have great institutions of art and things of that nature. And we're doing a lot better job, I think, in the last decade or so. But I think it's so interesting to read Schrake's point of view and then think about it versus your point of view, which I also think is absolutely right, that you can kind of get the purest strains of America right here. So I just want to throw that out there and get you to reflect on it and how you think this place sort of sets up for these really different shades.
Yeah, I think he was absolutely on point. I mean, it's good for business if things are running smoothly, if people are, you know, doing what they're told to do, if they're not too excited, if they're not too thoughtful. I mean, the best way to sell somebody something is to make them numb and dumb. And even better if they have money to spend. I think, yeah, he was really onto something there. I think in Dallas, this kind of management of social life reached an art form probably in the 1950s. When we had a series, up till then we'd had a series of unelected mayors. Like Wallace Savage liked to joke, he said, "I was the last unelected mayor of Dallas," and that was in the 1950s. It was these guys, the Dallas Citizens Council, you know, the guys down at Republic Bank, you know, they were really good at running the city for their benefit and for keeping a lid on things. And you can see it in the books. I mean, there was an extraordinary book written that came out in 86 called The Accommodation by Jim Schutz, and it was actively suppressed by the Dallas establishment. It's just been reissued by Deep Vellum. And it's an extraordinary examination of power and how it worked in Dallas, you know, going back to the beginning, but with special emphasis on the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Right. And Jim is a colleague who I've worked with for many years, and I am excited for him that's getting to go back into print. I have to say, though, I feel like the Dallas that has evolved in the years that I've been here as a journalist is a much different place than the one that Schrake describes and that the history bears out, whether in the accommodation or elsewhere. I know you're working on other things now, but do you ever think you have another Dallas novel in you?
Well, I had one that I thought was going to come out around 2007 or 2008. It's called The Texas Itch.
Oh, and this is going to be the secret Ben Fountain novel.
And,
I like it.
And I sold it. We were working on revisions. I liked it, and my agent liked it. Ultimately, my editor said, "We think you can do better, and so we aren't going to publish it."
Oh, boy.
And, you know, so you go around in intense depression for about, you know, a month.
Yeah, what a gut punch, huh?
For a writer, it's like the absolute worst. Yeah. This is the thing you fear. You work on a book for years, and you think it's getting there, and then they say no. But, you know, the worst thing happened, and I realized, well, I'm still here. I still get to write. And so I picked myself up off the floor. Anyway, The Texas Itch, I still think about that book a lot, and maybe someday it will see the light of day. As far as another Dallas novel, yeah, you never know. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the Dallas that is emblazoned on the minds of people out there who think about Dallas with what it was don't necessarily understand the Dallas as it is. And I spend a lot of time as a journalist trying to explore that. But I think the Dallas that was, which is very aptly described in many ways in Billy Lynn, very much is with us, and very, you know, is as imprinted on the culture as whatever changes there have been. You did a brilliant job of capturing it.
And I've got to take us at least outside of Dallas,
sure,
where, as it relates to Billy Lynn, because I have not read the book, but I dove in and researched, and you know, learned all about you, learned about other works. But with Billy Lynn, where I was fascinated is there's a movie deal. You sell it to a large studio. It's well-funded. There's a big-time director. There's big-time actors involved. And I'm a guy that's flipping through Netflix all the time. And if there's a story about, you know, something cool happening at a Texas stadium with a, you know, a war background, I would be interested in that. And I hadn't seen it. So you got to take us through, how does a deal like that come together? And then what happened?
I cannot believe any movie ever gets made. Because so many things have to come together in the right sequence for it to happen. And I've been around Hollywood some enough to know just how, you know, just what a long shot it was. And so when the movies came calling for Billy Lynn, I felt like, well, we'll see. You know, yeah, I will sell the option for the movie rights and not expecting that anything would happen with it. But it kept clearing hurdles and things started shaping up really nicely. And got a great director, great actors. Everybody involved really wanted to make a good movie.
And the director had just had success, Life of Pi.
Yeah.
Was
yeah, his last two movies, he'd won
Lee as a
best director. Yeah, Ang Lee. I mean, everything was set up for it to be something special, and it flopped. And, I mean, it was a missed opportunity. I have a lot of respect for Ang Lee. I think he's a real artist and absolutely sincere in trying to make something real, you know, about human experience. The script fell far short of what it should have been. And there's a lesson for all of us out there. It always starts with the words. And if the words aren't on the page, if the words aren't right, you can peddle as hard as you can, but it's got to start with the words.
Where does that rate on the gut punch scale for you? Because it's obviously not your script, but it is an adaptation of your story. What do you carry with you feeling wise?
Well, I had made my peace from the very beginning. I thought the book is the book. Nothing they do with a movie adaptation is going to change a single word in the book. So the book is the book. The movie will be a different beast. I did start to feel like we've got a chance for maybe something really special to happen here, which has nothing to do with me, really. It's the movie's got to be its own beast. You know, I still feel like I won the lottery. I got to take the ride, you know, and the ride was a lot of fun to see that process play out and to... you know, to hang out with Aang some. And so, you know, it was a great life experience.
So, Ben, tell us who you're... First of all, I want to get into the literary prize that you're involved with now and tell us a little bit about that. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about who you're excited about, who's writing around us now, who we maybe we can introduce some people to some names. You're the Dallas writer that I read, and I probably should be. You've broadened my universe before, but who should we be interested in right now?
Well, you know, just to talk a little bit about the Republic of Consciousness Prize, Laurie Feathers, who's co-owner of Interrobang Books,
great store.
It is a great store. She realized a few years ago there was this prize in the UK called the Republic of Consciousness Prize that recognizes and supports small publishers and with a particular focus on fiction. And she just assumed there was something like that in the U.S. and did some, you know, investigating, and there isn't. And so she has started the U.S. version of the Republic of Consciousness Prize, and I'm serving as a judge this first year with pleasure, and we're just starting to get first submissions. But yeah, I think small publishers are a critical part of, you know, the literary ecosystem, and this larger project of trying to understand who we are and where we're going, you know, as individuals and as a society, And so it's really vital work that their efforts be supported. And it's a prize. I think it's going to become a big deal, you know, over the years, and it's based here in Dallas. And I hope Dallas takes ownership of it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody you're excited about that you're reading?
You know, I think one of the best writers in the world lives down the street from me.
Okay.
And
that's what we wanted to hear.
His name is David Searcy. And he just had his fourth book come out, published by Random House. And it's a book of essays called The Tiny Bee That Hovers at the Center of the World. And David is an extraordinary writer. And his previous book was called Shame and Wonder, also published by Random House. And then early in the 2000s, he had two really fine novels published by Viking, and both in the horror genre. And yeah, I can see how it would be presented that way to the public, but there's really a lot more going on. I mean, a lot more in the nature of existential inquiry. So I think he's an extraordinary writer, David Searcy.
Love it. I got something to go read now.
Yeah, and then Robert Trammell was a Dallas poet, and he was born in 1939, died in 2006. He was a mentor to me and a lot of other people in Dallas. And he came out with this quirky book, short book, in the 1990s called Jack Ruby and the Origins of the Avant-Garde in Dallas. And it was a cult classic, very small print run. Anyway, Deep Vellum is bringing out a reissue of it in November, and along with a big batch of Bob's short stories. And you know, just working with Will Evans over at Deep Vellum and going through Jack Ruby and the Origins of the Avant-Garde in Dallas, I mean, I realized Bob really struck a nerve. He hit a vein there of this pure Americana, this combination of you know, American schizophrenia, all balled up into the John F. Kennedy assassination, Jack Ruby, Charlie Starkweather, and the murderous rampage he went on through the American heartland in the late 1950s, and the situation over at the Art Museum, you know, the anti-communist art crusade in Dallas in the early 1960s. And Bob balled it all up into this wonderfully surreal mix and got it on the page somehow. Anyway, that's coming out in November.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is, you won't remember this, but that is, you loaned me like a copy of that moons and moons ago, and your only admonition was, I got to have this back because there's not any of them. I kind of remember it being a bunch of loose leaf paper or something. I might be making that up, but I had to go put it in your mailbox when I was done with it, because there was like, you were like, there's six of these things around, and I got one of them or something.
Whatever
the details were, I had to give it back to you.
Actually, Bob self-published it in the form of a little chat book.
Okay.
But very artfully done, and the graphics were just completely on point with what the text was doing. And Deep Vellum, I mean, they do a beautiful job, and they have preserved those graphics and really captured the spirit of the chat book in their presentation. But I think that's a wonderful book we can look forward to next month.
Absolutely.
Well, I've got my Dallas literary to-do list. I've got Searcy, I've got Trammell, and of course, Fountain. Ben Fountain, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Really enjoyed learning kind of where you've been and what's ahead. It's exciting.
Thanks, guys. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Ben.
And to our audience, thank you for listening to the podcast. Feel free to email us at deepside@dallasnews.com with questions, comments, and ideas. For Rudy Bush, I'm Paul Corliss. We'll talk to you soon. The Deep Side of Dallas is presented by the Dallas Morning News and the University of North Texas System. Our show is produced by Aiden Barrett.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please support the local journalism behind it. Go to join.dallasnews.com and select a membership that works for you. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bush.
And I'm Paul Corliss. Thanks for listening.